Hello, welcome to Left Ungagged, Scotland's premier political podcast. It's been another hectic week in Scottish politics, plenty to talk about. Nicola Sturgeon's been confirmed as the First Minister. She's announced her new cabinet. There's been sightings of Home Office enforcement vans around the Greater Glasgow area. We had a debate down at Westminster about how much they're willing to spend to renovate the crumbling palace of Westminster. And the Scottish Government announced that the Indian variant of the COVID-19 virus will now be referred to as the April 02 variant. I'll be your host, Stephen McClement, transmitting from the Blantyre Free State, and I am the only member of the Green Party that does not own a bike. It has been a change-up in the lineup this week. We still had a bit of a sub, our usual contributor, Brian, is jet setting as usual. He's around down in London at the moment, so he'll be back next week. I'm sure you'll be happy to hear. But we'll get a very able replacement. It's Ungagged's very own roving reporter. She's the furious fiddler of the South Side. It is Val Waldron. Also joining us, we have the eighth most electable SNP member in the west of Scotland, Mulgay's digital Michelangelo, Miss Deborah Torrance. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice, nice to hear you smile. So how are yous? Good to see yous. Val, welcome to your first appearance on the Holyrood podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the intro. It's probably more furious than fiddler. And I have to say, we're now part of a group of deviants, green members that don't own a bike, so all good.
I thought that
Deborah,
was a
how
myth.
Are you?
I'm good, yeah, thank you. I thought it was a myth. Greens, I thought all Green members owned the bike.
I thought it was the only one. I feel as if you're infringing on my brand there, Val.
We gave them away to a good cause. All very good and green.
Okay, so another kind of interesting week in Scottish politics. After the election a couple of weeks ago, that's now officially confirmed that Nicola Sturgeon is re-elected as First Minister. There was two other candidates, but Nicola Sturgeon won with 64 votes ahead of Mr. Douglas Ross in 31, and Mr. Rennie, who got 4 votes. I feel as if we're always having a go at Willie Rennie, but we'll end up doing it again because the poor soul picked up 4 votes in his election for First Minister.
Well, you know, I have got a real soft spot for Willie Rennie. I kind of like him like a protagonist in a story, you know, like that you're not meant to like. I like him.
he's growing on me. And I suppose I feel quite sorry for him. That number 4, really, 4 members isn't going to do them an awful lot of good in this parliament. But, you know, the pair of them, well, all of them, the opposition leaders doing their wee speech before the First Minister, and yes, poor Willie saying that, you know, more or less begging, please don't appoint a minister for the constitution. I just get kind of sorry for him, I must admit.
Yeah, I mean, I met Willie Rennie once and he was really nice, so I kind of feel bad, but we seem to keep sort of giving him a hard time, despite none of his particularly wanting it. It just kind of seems to happen. So well, if you're listening, Willie, we don't mean it. It's on good jest.
Absolutely.
Well, his 4 votes matches four elected representatives, don't they?
I would guess the 4 votes came for the Liberal Democrats. That's my insight. That's my insight to that election. But Douglas Ross, who we all know and love. He made a speech where he explained how he wanted to grow up to be a dairy farmer, and he would never believe that one day he'd be a candidate for First Minister, and that the Tories were aspiring to govern the dairy industry's loss is politics gain, or probably the other way about, to be quite honest.
So you wanted to be a dairy farmer and a referee? Not a...
And an MP. And an MSP.
And First Minister.
He just wants all the jobs.
Yeah, I'm losing track of that guy, the jobs he wants.
I think he was coming under a bit of pressure again recently to resign his Westminster seat, but I think the Tories know if they do, they'll have a good chance to lose that seat, so they're just going to dig their heels in and hold on to it for the next 2 to 3 years or whenever Boris decides to call another general election.
Did I hear that Boris Johnson's engaged again?
I don't know. This is news to me.
I just read it on Twitter this morning. I just wanted to know if it was real or if it was one of the Twitter things.
Hey, Boris, I can't keep up with Boris's love life.
Can anybody? No. So
his wife certainly had trouble keeping up with his love life.
No, nobody can keep up with his kids either.
We swiftly moved on from slagging Willie Rennie to just full on let's slag the Tories. I like that.
Well, when in doubt, slag the Tories. You know, it's a popular thing today in Scotland.
So Nicola Sturgeon as First Minister, was anybody surprised?
No.
I mean, it's great actually. Really, I listened and watched twice because I just really enjoyed. I have to say, I enjoyed seeing the woman smiling and standing there, sort of like as if right, I got rid of all the nonsense that was going on in the past few months, and this is it. And very generously, sort of thanking the opposition for their well-meant comments, etc. And here's me thinking, oh, well, this Douglas Ross was wanting to call a vote of no confidence, so that's very good of you. But I thought it was a really strong speech. I thought it was really good, and it seemed, you know, very well intended and straight in there. Where she's, you know, the first thing, a zero carbon economy, strong, important stuff, and you know, and a lot of stuff about her family and everything. Yeah, it got me anyway. Got me going. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think now, like, assuming there's no great sort of thing to change that we don't foresee, that Nicola Sturgeon will probably now become the longest serving First Minister. She's been in the post, 7 years now? And is Alex Salmond was the longest serving before that?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, he was in about 7 years as well. So come next year, she'll be the number one in terms of longevity.
Yeah, well, we are still trying to catch up on how many lady leaders there have been. Quite a few now, eh? I wasn't awfully impressed with Anna Sarwar's wee bit as well, because he described Nicola as a campaigner speaking for half the country. And I thought that was a bit disingenuous, to be honest, because I think, if anything, I think the lead, okay, it was kind of soft yes lead, but all the, you know, the yesers that came on board during the last year were really there, I think, because it's quite clear that she was speaking for all the countries. So, and I think she really reinforced that as well in her wee speech there. So, yeah.
I think the daily COVID briefing showed that she really was there to serve the whole of Scotland, not just, you know, SNP supporters. I thought that was a great demonstration of her, you know, ability. So I think it's a good thing she's First Minister again. And then we've got the new cabinet, don't we? So who is it? John Swinney is Deputy First Minister.
Yeah, gender balance cabinet.
Yeah. Very nice. Who else? Shirley Ann Somerville for Cabinet Secretary for Education and Skills. Keith Brown, Cabinet Secretary for Justice. Hamza Yousaf, Cabinet Secretary for Health and Social Care. Kate Forbes, Cabinet Secretary for Finance and the Economy. Mary Goujon, Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs and Islands. Angus Robertson, Cabinet Secretary for the Constitution, External Affairs and Culture. Michael Matheson, Cabinet Secretary for Net Zero Energy and Transport. And Shona Robinson, for Cabinet Secretary for Social Justice, Housing and Local Government. What do you think about these folks?
What kind of occurred to me is how unfamiliar I actually am with a lot of the sort of individuals in government. Like, I kind of looked and recognised a lot of the names, but there's a couple of names that I thought were new, and then when I looked, like, I realised how out of touch I must have been. Like, totally missed that Kate Forbes had already been in the finance job.
Yeah.
And I always think back to when I was a wee boy, and I put it down to spitting image that I used to know, like, all the members of the cabinet really well. And I just don't have the same familiarity now with a lot of people.
I'm glad it's new just you, David, yeah, because, I mean, Michael Matheson, familiar name and everything, but, you know, I don't really know much about his record, and he's got one hell of a task as well. He's got the net zero energy transport COP26 delivery, no pressure there. But I think the ones that I'm kind of was drawn to really, like, a couple of new faces in the cabinet, Mary McCallan and Sean Edson and Mary Goujon. And they are, that's the biggie, isn't it? You know, the sort of environment and land reform, rural affairs, etc. And I think the fact that, okay, there were plenty of journalists, you know, same old, you know, that's why they call it a reshuffle. But I think when you see like the kind of revive and rewilding groups, etc., feeling quite hopeful and excited by an appointment, that's got to be a good thing. So, I mean, you've got Mary McCallan with her. She's got apparently a background in environmental law and has some, you know, experience as sort of advisory role in these issues. So, all good there. Well, very hopeful about that side of things.
Deborah?
I thought it was interesting, John Swinney, getting the Cabinet Secretary for COVID recovery, because that's a thankless task, that, isn't it? It's, how can he, you know, unless he's got, I don't know, microbiologist insight into stuff, I don't know how he's really going to be able to tackle that as efficiently as, you know, we know John Swinney likes to get his teeth into things, so.
He's probably a decent choice from the point of view that he's held sort of a lot of ministerial positions, so he's probably quite familiar with a lot of different aspects of government, and obviously the pandemic's impacted in a lot of different ways. You know, it's impacted in education, obviously health, you know, the economy, you know. So I'm guessing that's probably why he was picked for that job. But
definitely you'll have, you know, an insight into it from different, as you say, experiences at different ministerial levels, and maybe he's the best person for it. I kind of feel sorry for him.
Sorry for him anyway. I mean, he's kind of got rid of one poison chalice education, passed it on, dropped the ball. But he keeps calm, you know, and remember, and I guess he's going to be the one that's facing up to all these journalists with their quite often quite daft questions and keeping quite calm there. But yes, yeah, so I don't know. Humza Yousaf, that's an interesting one. I was kind of pleased for him in a way, because he's had a horrible time as Justice Minister with the whole hate crime legislation and everything. I mean, it's been a bit of a thorn in his side. So I understand he's responsible for the startup of the National Care Service. Is that right? That's part of his role as well. So hopefully that's a good thing, a good new thing to get his teeth into.
Here's a kind of hypothetical. If Nicola Sturgeon was to decide that she'd had enough, which I think after the last kind of year or so she's had, I wouldn't blame her. Who do you think would be able to step up and sort of fill her shoes? I think that, because the big set of shoes to fill, because you know, she has really became such a big figure in Scottish politics. I mean, you think about possibly going into a referendum campaign. I struggle to imagine somebody that could step into that role and sort of lead it.
Yeah, I don't think there's a better person to lead Scotland right now. I can't see. I mean, I know there's plenty of people who might think they could do that role, but I don't think there's many that could do it as efficiently or just as graciously, really, because she's really respected, you know, all over the world from other countries, like from countries that we respect, like New Zealand, or, you know, with Jacinda, they seem to be besties. I like that idea. And you know, like Leanne Wood from Wales, they're really, you know, close colleagues, Nicola and Leanne. I just think that the only sort of person capable of that same gravitas, maybe Angus Robertson. I mean
certainly if there was a leadership contest, he would be one of the sort of bookies' favourites, but I couldn't imagine Angus Robertson kind of connecting with the sort of broad Scottish electorate the way Nicola Robertson does.
Nicola Robertson, she know
Nicola Robertson.
She's from Girls Aloud.
No more rumours. We don't need any more rumours.
I know you'll start another conspiracy theory, David.
Actually kind of see. I mean, I know the media likes to talk about Coombs and Kate Forbes, but I don't know. I'm really proud. I'm a bit of a fangirl at the moment, even although politically I'm not always on side with Nicola, but I'm quite proud to, you know, be in her constituency, to have kind of put one of the exes in the box there. And I must say, it's really good to see her out and about in, like, sometimes our back lanes, you know, when they have the festivals in the summer and stuff. And I think anybody seeing her in real life, I mean, she's very, very diplomatic, very good on camera, but she's such a people person, you know, to actually just see her in the flesh and in action, she is a real people person. And I think there are sociable people, and then there are people persons, and that's different. And I think she's going to be a tough one to follow. That's the truth. I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, John Swinney, obviously, is quite a senior member in the government, and he obviously was SNP leader, but he wasn't very successful in that role before. I mean, that was quite a long time ago now when you think about it. It was about, 2003 election he was the SNP leader. He was the SNP leader when they sort of, there was the Rainbow Parliament, which mostly came at the expense of the SNP when there was the first sort of Green, when the Greens get 7 seats before and when the SSP gets 6 seats. Yeah, so I don't know, maybe he thinks like 17 years later, more seasoned, maybe he'd feel more capable of doing the job, but you don't really get second chances in politics that often, so... Mm.
Yeah. What about Lorna Slater? There's a bit of a reach across the...
for SNP leaders, that would be...
For any leader, I'll take her.
I like Lorna Slater a lot. I'm very impressed with her trapeze skills. I like that.
She definitely had a great election campaign. Like her profile, like going from zero to like really quite well known now, I would say. She does have that sort of similar quality, Nicola Sturgeon. I think that she's memorable when she kind of connects with people.
Very personable.
I think looking at the cabinet, that's the kind of quality a lot of them are lacking. I would say Humza Yousaf has that. Mm-hmm. But whether he would, you know, feel ready for that kind of position yet, or I don't know, maybe a bit soon for him.
When you were talking about coming from the south side and feeling really proud, in case some of our listeners don't know, Val is our roving reporter who gave us some of the videos from the Kenmure Street incident. She was there on the ground. I just want to say yes, well done for that. But there was some enforcement vans spotted around the city again recently. Did you see that?
Yeah, I think there was one spotted in Paisley and somewhere else in Glasgow, I think there was.
Aye, up my end, up at Drumchapel.
So I mean, we saw like Kenmure Street, you know, the internet sort of sprung into action quite quickly. You saw the things getting retweeted and the information spreading. And almost as quickly as it sprung up, there was reports that the van had moved on. So I just hope that sort of awareness stays with people.
So I was a bit concerned. I had seen that the Home Office has done this before in other areas where they use like diversionary tactics when there's been great community response to incidents, that they then send out vans just to test the waters to see where can we go that we're not going to get picked up. And I was also talking to government person, shall we say, and they said that it's not just as a diversionary tactic, sometimes it's literally to see how well the community is going to respond in future. So just to always be aware, if you see the an enforcement van, do your bit, get on the Twitter, tweet no evictions. Or the Unity Centre, yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose as well, if they keep sort of just sending vans out for wee drives, you know, people will get a bit used to seeing them and maybe no react quite as quickly as we've seen this week. So that's on us as well, just to, no matter how many sort of false alarms, you know, we can't get complacent. We need to keep reacting when there is a sign to them.
Well, there's still the other Indian guy that was picked up, unfortunately, on the same day, I think just before.
Yeah, from a homeless unit, I believe.
Yeah, he was in Dungable, you know, and obviously Ken Muir Street made the news and the First Minister mentioned it in her speech there and everything, you know, it's a big thing, but unfortunately, you know, it's happening all around us. And so, you know, is it the return of, as you say, you know, the return of the dawn raids, or has it, have we just noticed them again? Did we just pick up on them again? It's difficult to know.
Well, I think Priti Patel has, she went out in her cagoule, didn't she? Home Secretary, and I think she is making a purposeful attempt to, I don't even know how to say it any other way other than to get rid of people.
She seems to be making a concerted effort to portray herself as a Bond villain. It's like, it's like as if she's getting advised and how to, like, here's your image, your brand is I'm an evil bastard and this is how we're going to keep perpetuating your brand. It's a strange thing to see.
My girlfriend said she looks like the baddie in all the Marvel. She looks like a Marvel villain. Because she's just standing there, aren't she, looking?
There was some great memes as well. There was a picture of her sort of like evil, like staring, sort of smiling, evil, looking at a laptop. And there was a lot of kind of people cutting in pictures of like Bambi's mum getting shot and her sort of like smiling maniacally at it.
She has a presence for sure. But, you know, and at the same time as we were kind of homing in on her anorak with a cagoule, whatever it was, with the Home Secretary thing on, there was Johnson's, he had a logo or something, didn't he? Didn't he have something that had a...
Yeah, it was a kind of vaguely military thing. I can't remember the details.
It was very Air Force One. Like, remember President Trump wore those sort of bomber jackets with a... insignia. It was very reminiscent of that.
But ready just... for action is the message. Yeah, it's quite deliberate as well. Yeah, they're ready for action.
I want to know who's got their merchandise contract. Like, I bet it's one of their pals.
Sure,
probably landlord in one of the local pubs.
Yeah, no, I want to. Do you remember in? There's an old black and white film of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. The guy runs up to Notre Dame and shouts, "Sanctuary, sanctuary," and then get in. So I was wondering, why doesn't Scotland have a nationwide sanctuary law? Like, you could, if you get to a mosque, if you get to a church, any place of worship still to this day, because of a 7th century law, you can still claim sanctuary, and the police, they don't, I don't think they have to abide by the law, but they seem to generally respect that. And I think Scotland, we should extend that to any sort of public space. If you get to like a library, if you can get to the council buildings, if you can, you know, anywhere that is somewhere official, you can say, I claim sanctuary, and then the Home Office can go and get one. Get done.
Well, I know in America when Trump was really kind of in the immigration, so ICE was like pushing, like deporting a lot of people. A lot of the sort of democratic cities were setting themselves up as sanctuary cities. I don't really know what a lot of the detail around it is, but it was basically like refusing to cooperate with the sort of federal government in those areas. I mean, certainly Scotland could probably do something similar then and refuse any official cooperation with sort of the Westminster authorities in terms of immigration, and like, you know, Police Scotland could certainly do more to impede. But I don't know if there's like, would we need to pass a law for that? I don't know what the details are.
Well, Police Scotland need to sort themselves out and work out what their role is here, because they really were the stooges on the Kenmore Street day. And I mean, I kind of felt that myself, like just wandering around, walking down there. The police, there was something about wandering through, trying to walk through all the police vans. I've never seen so many police vans in my pub apart from some great big demos, and they were moving there. And it was almost as though it was like a deliberate tactic. That felt quite threatening, backward and forward, slowly kind of reversing, and they didn't need to be. But when you got to the actual porous lines, fine, you just can elbow your way through and they're fine. And I just felt they didn't know what they were doing, you know, they didn't, they weren't, the only kind of threatening thing about them was when you could see them lined up quite organised around the corner as though they were kind of waiting for orders. But I just felt really, they really don't know what they're doing. And even like the Scottish Police Authority, the SPA, they're sort of like passing the buck, saying, oh, well, you know, we're quite happy to see the operational independence by the Chief Constable. And the Chief Constable just keeps repeating back, you know, we're only here to keep the peace or whatever, keep you safe. But,
yeah, I mean, that was kind of a bit encouraging when they were saying, like, you know, their role is only to do with preserving public order, and that they weren't sort of there to, you know, enforce the sort of immigration removals.
Just their presence being there, that sort of does the opposite of that. That's almost as if, say, the police are here, need they, what they say.
But at the same time, you know, if they hadn't been there and you just had a huge crowd and like the couple of immigration officials, somebody might have, one of the people in that van might have panicked and tried to drive away with somebody underneath, you know, so yeah. It could have went, there are a lot of ways that could have went really badly wrong if Police Scotland hadn't turned up. So it's maybe not just as simple as, you know, cutting off any contact and not responding. I hate defending the polls.
No, I was going to say you enjoying the boots. I was just thinking that were the police there from the very beginning, or were they only called in response to the demonstrators turning up, do you know?
I believe it was a response, but Val might know better.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just heard the first task. I think we were all aware of it at the same time. There was a post appeared online and on Twitter, and I just kind of let right on my way down. I didn't think about it. And as far as I was concerned, it was a small, distanced, well-organised, masked thing, and there were police knocking around. But, you know, the most, you were kind of within spitting distance of the monitor. Of the actual
metaphorical spitting.
Yes, metaphorically speaking, of course, of the Home Office police, and they were a whole different, you couldn't kind of like take your eye off them, you know.
Really?
Pretty tough looking guys. But no, the police, they just kept coming. Same as pretty much along with the demonstrators. It just all kept growing. When the time I left, there was an awful lot more of them than when I came. And when I went back after the phone charge, as I say, they were mulling around in the vans, moving around like flies. Like
so it went from a handful to a force. Yeah,
force. And also thinking about your sanctuary thing, Deborah, when that amazing moment, so well documented, thank goodness, when the vans were opened and the guys came out. And at that time, we were having to, like, you know, lift our phones above the crowd to see anything, because it's pretty big. But going to sanctuary, even although the guys were sick, you know, obviously going to a mosque, that was your kind of place of sanctuary, and that's a moving thing. But, you know, the first mass of marchers were, like, you know, crowds and crowds of police, just a wee bit more than a kind of escort, but, you know, they were straight into action there, you know, so... Yeah, so they know their stuff, but they still don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else about the sort of sanctuary thing you wanted to talk about there?
No, that was pretty much it.
It'd be interesting to see if it was feasible to do something like that. Like, there definitely feels as if the Scottish government could do more. I mean, they reacted well, but it was certainly more, it was an organic sort of response to the community that really drove it. And you felt as if the Scottish government were sort of trying to catch up a bit.
Well, they were doing other things, weren't they? They were swearing in and...
Well, that's true. but generally, in response to sort of Westminster's sort of immigration policies, you wonder if there is ways that they could block it more. Like, and again, it's a wee bit like a lot of my criticism of the SNP is like they're too keen to play by the rules and be good boys and girls. You know, I'm sure, like, could you do things, things a bit outside the box, like, if immigration are trying to remove somebody, can you just suddenly decide that the roads at each end of that street need dug up and box them in? You know, it was, like, during the COVID when they were wanting to kind of close the border and Westminster sort of weren't letting them do that, I was just thinking, well, could you not just suddenly decide all the motorways need resurfaced and just stick cones out and close them down?
Yeah,
you wouldn't be able to close every single street, but it would certainly, if you close the main arteries up and down, it would have made a big difference, I think.
It would certainly have stopped the BAMs from going out themselves, the hazmat suits or whatever they're called.
With their gas masks on. Mm-hmm. Aye, they could have just like decided to renovate the entire M74 corridor.
Like they do quite often.
Yeah, anyway. Talking about renovations, what was your next thing on the agenda, David?
Yeah, so one day last week, they spent a whole day in Westminster debating how much they're going to spend to renovate the palaces of Westminster. And again, a bit like we were talking about HS2 last week, some of the numbers are eye-watering. Mm-hmm. When you consider all the scandal and all the debate and outrage about the Scottish Parliament building, and the cost spiraled to like 450 million, I think it was. They're talking about the cost to renovate the Palace of Westminster could be as high as 20 billion, and it's just like, how can that be justified? Like, you know, just build a new building, like turn it into a tourist trap and build a new Parliament in Birmingham or somewhere like that.
I don't even think it would come up to standard as a tourist attraction, to be honest. I've been in it. It is the most inaccessible building you've ever been in. I mean, it's pretty amazing. I love history, and as a historical building, it's stunning. It's like, it's amazing, but it shouldn't be a functioning place of government. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. It is so archaic and everything is so ancient. Like, because I was in my wheelchair, they took me through the palace that, you know, the bit where you go in, you can stand where Winston Churchill stood and all that, and it's the Abbey, I'm sure it's called, and they take you into the main building, which is where you can go one way to the Lords or one way to the chamber, but we had to go through all the lobbies, and as you go through the lobbies you see their filing system. They've got all these things and all these leather bound books and glass cabinets, and as you go through the lobbies you suddenly become aware these are really small. Like, there's 600, how many MPs is there? 600?
650, I think.
Yeah, and there's not
and
enough,
and even more in the Lords.
Exactly. And there's not enough space for all the MPs. And I was lucky enough to get inside the MP's office, which is also tiny, like probably the size of this bedroom I'm in. It's so small. And it just, the lift, like you had to go all the way around the building to get up a lift. And it's just, it's such, I just think it would be so better repurposed as you say, some sort of a tourist or tourist attraction, a museum or something. But I don't even think that it would be able to facilitate the tourists. So I don't know how people actually manage to work there. it's I know it's right in the heart of London, all that's right in the city. There's wee back doors you can go out that takes you right into the subway, or what do they call it in London? Underground. But it's just it's like it's trying to fulfill a 21st purpose, you know, like a 21st century purpose with a, I don't know, when was it built, 15 something?
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing about it as well. It's not as old as people think. You know, it looks ancient, and it is old, but it's not as old as it looks. It was purposely built to look old and
intimidating,
create this sense of history that, you know, isn't quite true.
Yeah,
I visited it once, and I was actually really shocked at how small the debating chamber was. It was like, it looks quite grand and cavernous, and when you see it on TV, but it's tiny. It's like really small.
Smaller than really the school gym, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. And really unimpressive. Like, it doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel like a parliament. It doesn't feel like an important place when you're in it. It seems like a very fancy, you know, local council or something. In fact, I've been in the Glasgow City Chambers. Glasgow City Chambers is probably a bit more impressive in some parts.
Well, I haven't been in there. I did actually go, I'm going to show my age here, but when I was doing my training in Cardiff, we went through for the day and watched Thatcher and Kinnock going at it across the floor.
Was it, you mean debating?
Did you take rotten tomatoes?
I was just like, this should be amazing, but it was just really boring, actually, whatever their point was that day. But I must admit, okay, I hadn't heard the debate in the day, and I couldn't face kind of finding it on video, but I started to read it. Got it, and I'm thinking, because Rees Mogg, his whole thing is about, I'm thinking, well, he's a relic within a relic. He wants to stay there. He's got himself, you know, all the pictures of the names from last year of him lounging about in the sofas or the benches. That's it. That's where he wants to stay. And he's even said, you know, he's more or less saying, renovate it roundabout as it'll be fine. And it doesn't really need to be completely wheelchair accessible. He doesn't give a monkey's.
I was just going to say, that's one of the things. Like, he's one of, and he's not alone. There's like, that is quite a strong groundswell. MPs that they want them, they don't want to leave it even temporarily, which is one of the reasons the cost is so high. I think there was another option that if they camped to somewhere else for like a year or so, or 2 years, whatever it was, it would cost like a fraction of the amount. It would still be like billions, but it wouldn't be 20 billion.
Yeah, Jacob Rees-Mogg as well wants to hurry everything back to pre-COVID procedures, so that means no more Zoom meetings, no more voting electronically, all the things that came about because of the pandemic that made everything so much more accessible for our representatives to be able to, you know, do their job. He's wanting to regress that and also not update the panel, you know. He's a living relic, as you say.
He wants the worst of both worlds, in other words. But I must admit, you see, I started to get a wee bit sucked into some of the stuff, and I thought, no, yeah, I don't have any problem with, you know, maintaining old buildings and whatnot. And then suddenly, like, push, here comes Kirsty Blackman saying, hang on a minute, you know, we should be debating furlough payments and Dawn rates and EU settlement schemes and stuff that's urgent that needs done now. And she's saying, don't worry about us 59, because you know you won't be needing space for us here after independence. And she's saying, and don't worry about the House of Lords, because they're relics as well. I thought, my God, no wonder they can't stand the SNP. They certainly have their place waking them up sometimes. But just 20 billion, I think. I had a wee look at what a billion could buy, and apparently 2015, 300,000 job seekers allowances for a year, 26,000 nurses or 12,000 hospital doctors, and that's only 1 billion. So it kind of boggles your mind, you know, when you think about it. And then all the carry on that we had in our parliament, which was about, I don't know, about 20 times more they want to spend than they did on that. So, yeah.
I think the, I mean, there is a section of particularly Tory MPs that are so detached from reality and so insular. Like, I don't remember who the MP was, but it was when they were having to shut down Big Ben for renovations. And so they all came out to hear the last bong for like a couple of years. And one of them was in tears, and you just think, with all the other stuff that goes on that you have to deal with as an MP, you know, like, and that's what moves you to tears, like, because you're not going to hear a big bell ringing for a couple of years. It's like they're in a different planet, some of them.
The Palace of Westminster was built 1,005 years ago, according to Wikipedia, in 1016, and then it was demolished due to fire in 1834 and rebuilt in 1840. So it took them 4 years to build the big monstrosity we see now. I mean, it is pretty. I think it
so
is.
It's less than 200 years old, but it was built in a way to make it look as if it's been there for thousands of years, almost like.
If I vaguely recall from my tour, I'm pretty sure the bit in the middle is quite a, like, that's one of the oldest bits that used to be there. I think they sort of
bit that dodged the fire.
Aye. But I'd have to Google that, and I don't really care about it that much. I think it should become something more functional, because I don't think it's very functional as the, you know, of what it is. But then I don't think the UK government is very functional. I mean, you've still got people walking about doing crazy traditions, like chanting a door with a big stick, and guys in wigs and ermine. And I mean, we need a 21st century government. We need a 21st century building for a 21st century government. Maybe it is quite functional for them, as you say. Jacob Rees-Mogg, he loves it.
Some of his language, it really is antiquated. I have no objection to a full decantation if it were nobler to the mind to suffer it, blah, blah, blah. What does he think he is?
Maybe he's just really into cosplay. Maybe we're misreading him.
He's cosplaying as a dick.
Doesn't have to try too hard. Can I just correct something in case I get accused of fake news here? Our Scottish Parliament, 400 million it cost, right, after a 50 million estimate. And the point about that is that the estimates can be wildly lower even than the actual cost. So what we're talking about in the end here could be something just phenomenal. So.
Yeah, I'm not a particularly big fan of the Scottish Parliament building, and just in terms of, I think when you look at it, it sort of doesn't really stand out. But by all accounts, it's an excellent building in terms of its functionality and to work in and all that, and it's a modern building. So as much as, you know, Westminster is quite iconic, like when you see a picture of it, you know, what do we really want out of government? We want one that works properly. We don't, it's secondary to have something that's, you know, looks nice in a postcard.
And I've made the lecterns in it. There we go.
And the Holyrood.
Scottish Parliament, yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The debating chamber, it's so nice. It's like circular. It's all about, you know, cooperation. Whereas in Westminster, it's all about division. You know what I mean? Arguing with each other, confrontation. That's what I think, anyway.
Yeah, I think I remember at the time they were saying that it was quite deliberate, like they chose the seats to be in a hemisphere, I think they referred to it as. Even when you were saying about the voting, the fact that at Westminster, every time they have a vote, they have to traipse through corridors. And it's like, that means like, if there's like, that, I think that takes about 20, 25 minutes or something like that. So if they get 5 votes a day, that's like a lot of the day taking up with just wandering corridors. When you could just, like, in the Scottish Parliament, you just press a wee button, and there we go, that's the result, that's the vote.
But going forward through our COVID recovery as well, they should be taking into account that not every member of Parliament is going to be able to travel down to London for their constituency. They should be putting these measures in place and for any future bloody pandemic that we have. I just think that it's so short-sighted, Jacob Rees-Mogg. But then, as we've found out, he's into cosplay, so probably doesn't he wear prescription glasses or believe in any sort of medicine.
It's the relic.
Yes.
Yeah, I think was it Mary Black spoke about some of the sort of antiquated aspects of Westminster, like, and it was Jacob Rees-Mogg like tried to convince her that the, you know, going around the court, like having traipse around the corridors was a great thing, because you could get the chance to speak to a minister about a constituency issue. And her reaction was, well, could we not just phone them? You know, like, there is other ways of getting in touch with people, you know, rather than have 650 elected members have to waste half an hour squeezing through a wee corridor just because one of them might have the chance to speak to
another one,
a minister about a certain issue. So also what happened this week is the Scottish government announced that the Indian variant of the COVID-19, they're no longer going to refer to it as that. From now on, they're going to refer to it as the April 02 variant. You know, a lot of people think it kind of Disney matter, but I think that's I think these things do matter, like words matter. And we've seen in America the way Trump behaved and tried to, you know, using phrases like Kung Flu and the Chinese virus, you know, that had real world effects. You know, like hate crimes against Chinese people went up in America, or just Asian people generally, because, you know, racists don't really distinguish between whether somebody's Chinese or from any other part of Asia. Like, yeah, they kind of lump them all together.
Side effect of being a racist, yeah. That stereotyping. I agree. I think it's a good thing we're trying to, you know, I just worry that, you know, April 02 variant, what happens if next year there's another variant and it's on April the 3rd? Are we going to start getting confused? I don't think it's that important. It's just a bit, I can understand why some people are like, why are they doing this? You know what people are like.
At the same time, you could just say, what if there's another variant that happens to be in India? So we would have two Indian variants. So that's just a confusion.
It's a good answer, that.
I think the Express, of course, you know, what do you think the Express are saying? You know, nobody cares. Nobody actually cares. It's just all political correctness gone mad. It's a while since I've heard that, Yinder.
I was going to say that. Political correctness, you don't hear about that now. You're usually, no, that's been completely woke. Replaced with woke. You know?
I know. It's very 80s.
We're not even keeping up with the times. But, yeah, so Leach is saying it's almost certainly going to be the dominant strain in Scotland. So, you know, we should get used to it. I agree. Hearing Trump going China variant.
What was it, the Wuhan flu, he kept calling it as well? It was like, what's wrong with you?
But apparently the WHO are going to bring in a naming system to avoid stigmatisation. And it's basically geographically and politically neutral. And I think that's a good thing. Yeah, that's a good thing.
So, did they say how they're going to name it? Is it going to be like storms? Are they all going to be named?
Yeah, no. Oh, you're letting people's names know.
Because that could be bad if it was the David strain.
Yeah, that was stigmatising people with certain names. Just imagine that, not getting in, because I know he's got the same name as that really bad variant. Let's not let him in. He must have it.
But that gives a good reason as why we've got to change the way we name them, I think. Yeah. I think we made that point well.
Yes, I was just listening yesterday to the news on the radio. Gary Robertson, giving Hamza Yousaf quite a horrible time, I would have said, but talking about this renaming, and he just, well, he actually, talking about COVID, he said, you call it something else. He didn't want to see what you call it or anything, you know, talk about contempt. But it will catch on, it will. We got used to COVID-19 and coronavirus, so drag them kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
At what point did we stop calling it coronavirus and move to COVID-19? I feel as if there was a point where we all called it coronavirus and then sort of we switched over. I wonder if that was
the beer lobby.
That's what I was wondering. Aye. See?
Pop down the road for us is called the corona.
Well, it does kind of show you actually that there is real world effects to terminology like that, because seemingly the Corona Lager did suffer a drop in sales, like, because of coronavirus.
Did they really?
I read it somewhere, maybe it wasn't true, but
maybe yeah, they changed it as well because there's so many coronaviruses, like, you know, that they don't all affect humans. So maybe it was people smarter than us coming in. We need to stop just calling it coronavirus.
I don't believe in those people.
No. Have we covered everything in your agenda? I'm just having a look.
Yeah, I think so.
Did you want to say something about the Eurovision tweet?
Yeah, we didn't have this in the agenda originally because it sort of just cropped up over the weekend with Eurovision Song Contest. I was working over the weekend. I didn't yet to see Eurovision. I'm not the biggest Eurovision fan, but I have known people through my life that were massive fans, so they sort of dragged me into it. But Rhiannon Spear tweeted when Britain get Neil Poir that, don't worry, something along the lines of, we hate the UK, United Kingdom too.
It's okay, yep. Europe, we hate the United Kingdom too, love Scotland, hashtag Eurovision.
And the reaction to this has been ludicrous, like accusations of racism, people, pro-independence people claiming that it's somehow blackening the cause of independence and tainting it with anti-UK, I suppose. I mean, I don't know how anybody that's progressive or pro-independence could not hate the UK because it's a horrible imperialist construct. It doesn't mean we hate everybody that lives in the UK because, well, unfortunately, we still live in the UK. And
it's an institution. How can you be racist to,
it's
you know...
Exactly.
It's not... The reaction, when you told me about it, I couldn't get onto Rhiannon's account because she's obviously was getting a hard time about it. And I just think... It's Eurovision. See, even if the gays are saying you're taking this a bit too seriously, maybe you need to calm down a bit. Like, it's everybody knows the UK's shite at Eurovision anyway. It's long established. I don't know why people are so have reacted in this way. It's just bullying, in my opinion. Doing pylons like that is just another form of bullying.
So an indie supporter, I think. Describing it as a herpes or something like that, some bad thing that wouldn't go away. And Adam Tompkins, of course, he was straight in, you know, we don't miss a trick.
Did you watch Eurovision by any chance?
I was working. The Neil Bond stuff.
Did you watch it, Valai?
Oh no, just I think I caught about four songs or something. I mean, and I was quite happy. I'm always quite happy just with the recap, about 2 or 3 seconds of the songs at the end. No, that's enough. That'll do me. And I'm sorry, but talking about rails, that's me. I just thought they were all rubbish.
Well, obviously it's a big gay night out. I love it. It's an annual thing usually. Didn't happen last year, and my favourite for a long time being Ukraine. I thought Iceland might have won it with their song last year, but because of the rules, they weren't allowed to re-enter the same song. So I think Iceland done well. They recycled their jumpers and they just sort of tweaked their song a bit. I really wanted Ukraine to do well, but UK song was rubbish. But the thing that was so hilarious about the Neil Poir, although they don't say Neil Poir anymore, they say zero. Zero Poir.
Smog will be furious about that loss of tradition now.
I know, that's terrible. I think he'd be a great Eurovision Song Contest host. Can you imagine him with all the... But it was, I mean, UK got beaten by an act where they had a woman dressed up as a hand.
I didn't see that
one. I saw a picture of that.
And the way they've set up the new voting, it's a bit like the Scottish Parliament. It's not meant to be, you're not meant to be able to get Neil Poir at all. You're meant to at least get 1 or 2 points, but nope, not UK. So Rhiannon's tweet, it was totally relevant to Eurovision. I've got a funny feeling that most of the people who got raging about it probably didn't watch the show.
I don't believe I don't believe that most of these people are actually offended or raging. These are just a lot of folk just with axes to grind. You know, there's the usual suspects in the unionist side just looking for any reason to try and stir up controversy and claim that being pro-independence is somehow means you hate English people. And then you've got some pro-independence people that have actually grinded against Rhiannon Spear because she supports trans rights. Yeah. And this is just, they've just found an opportunity to have a go at her and try to bully her, and it's pathetic. I mean, just scrolling through, looking at some of the tweets, and it's like so over the top. Like, here it is, absolutely shameful and pathetic, according to a Tory councillor. We deserve better than narrow-minded nationalists. I mean, dry your eyes, you know what I mean? It was a joke about Eurovision.
Exactly. The one I liked was bigoted and racist, just a step away from fascism. And I'm like, it's about Eurovision.
Was that a Tory thing?
Probably.
Sorry, I've just come across another tweet for Rhiannon Spear, which it says, at least the UK knows how Alba felt on the 6th of May.
That was the one I saw, yeah. Yeah, that caused a few issues.
Yeah. Burn, baby, burn. That's a good one.
So she's managed to upset the unionists and the indie dads. So
yeah,
a good day's work as far as I'm concerned.
Just solidarity to Rhiannon. Just want to put a shout out.
Yep,
the UK entry was shite.
And I want to say officially that I also hate the UK. That's why I want out.
I think that's a good note to end on.
Yep. I think that's us done for the week. Thanks very much. Thanks again, Deborah. Val, you've been great in your first appearance.
Oh, thank you. Enjoyed it.
As far as I know, I think Brian will be back next week, but you certainly will keep you in mind in future when we need a sub.
Do you want to give a shout?
Weather with pals about politics, you know, who's going to turn that down when you're a geek?
David, what are you saying there, Deborah?
Do you want to give a shout out to your band for the theme tune?
Oh, yeah. We've got a new theme tune this week. You've heard it at the start. It's by the Glasgow band Hippie. I just want to thank them for allowing us to use their song. And you can find them on Twitter at Hippie Music. And they've actually recently been signed to a record deal, so good on them. And if you want to get in contact with Ungagged, you can find us at _Ungagged on Twitter. We're also on Facebook. And if you want to email in any suggestions, anything you want us to talk about, any questions, you can email us at ungaggedleft@gmail.com and just include Hollywood podcast in the subject line so we can find it easily. So again, guys, thanks for joining us, and we'll be here next week.
Thank you. Thanks everybody.
Bye-bye.
For listening.
Bye.
Bye. It's wild, and it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice to hear you smile.